the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again, welcome to the show. Coming up, the new gun laws pass the lower house with a country-city divide kind of feel to it, and a multi-million dollar network of fire-spotting cameras in southern New South Wales have already proved their worth.
You know, and that could go on for hours when the weather's volatile, especially high winds, because there's highways where there's a crash. Machinery can do a spark when they're doing harvest time. Hay can self-combust in their hay sheds. Things like that can happen, and so that can start a grass fire and it can get going very quickly.
More on that story shortly. You can always text us here at the Country Hour with your comments on the stories. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour. But first up to those gun laws and the Minns government's contentious bill to tighten gun laws and to ban mass protests in the wake of the Bondi massacre has cleared the first parliamentary hurdle with a late night vote in the lower house. It passed 59 votes to 15 and now it's before the upper house. Independent member for Wagga Wagga Joe McGurr voted against the bill last night and he told Melinda Hayter there is a clear regional city divide on the proposed gun laws.
Well, the bill that we were dealing yesterday dealt mainly with issues around gun control, but there was also a change to protest laws and the use and the ability of police to remove face coverings, as well as restricting public assemblies after terrorist incidents. But my concern was with the gun laws, and my concern was that this was rushed legislation and that the changes that have come into effect in such a rushed way, I think will have very limited effect in terms of the gun laws, in terms of preventing another incident like the one at Bondi. And they were brought in with very, very, almost no, I would say, consultation with stakeholders, particularly gun owners. Now, that's fine in metro areas, but in rural and regional areas, guns are a part of work. They're a part of primary production. I was just very, very concerned that the government did not take that into account.
I understand. I think there were 15 MPs who voted against the laws. I understand that the Nationals, as a party, opposed the laws. You obviously joined them. Was it other regional MPs who also voted against the laws, or did we see city-based MPs vote against them as well?
It was actually, regional MPs. Myself, Roy Butler from Barwon, Phil Donato, Helen Dalton, and also Wendy Tuckerman crossed the floor on a number of occasions to vote. She's a Liberal from Goulburn. So it was really a representation of regional MPs. Look, I suspect, I can't speak for them, I suspect there were concerns in the regional MPs from the Labor Party, but they would have had very strict party discipline. It was quite clear that the perception of the use of guns between city and regional areas is quite different. And I have to say, I think I received a number of representations, as did other regional members, and they were well thought out representations. They really considered what the issues were. I get that restricting the number of guns that people own, people can see that, particularly in city areas, that makes sense. But in regional areas and for sports shooters who are very, very careful with their guns, the legislation just needed to be considered a little bit more. The bill could have been introduced, it could have been discussed through January, and it could have been worked on and passed in February. So it was the rush, really, that I think was the major concern.
Do you think the laws will pass the upper house today?
The current upper house is entirely unpredictable, I have to say. I think probably the Liberal Party and the Labor Party will combine and we'll have the numbers.
That's member for Wagga Wagga, Joe McGurr, speaking there with Melinda Hayter.
The Country Hour.
And we bring together all the threads of science.
The Country Hour.
An amazing community where a lot of people grow their own food.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories on ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
A multi-million dollar network of fire spotting cameras in southern New South Wales has already proven its worth, detecting smoke at times when watchtowers are unmanned. The New South Wales Bushfire Inquiry, after the Black Summer fires, recommended greater investment in remote sensing technology like these AI-powered cameras for early detection, as Emily Doak reports.
Tumut for Kendall. Wind direction southwest. Wind speed 5, gusting up to 10.
Over summer, Catherine Clark spends up to 10 hours a day in a high tower overlooking softwood plantations in southern New South Wales. She's not here for the panoramic views, but to watch for smoke.
Because even if it's small or a little bit, if they believe it's smoke, they need to act on that because you're on alert the whole time. You know, and that could go on for hours when the weather's volatile, especially high winds, because there's highways where there's a crash, machinery can do a spark when they're doing harvest time, hay can self-combust in their hay sheds, things like that can happen, and so that can start a grass fire and it can get going very quickly.
Catherine can't be on lookout all the time. But new cameras are using artificial intelligence to detect smoke columns and then deliver real-time alerts to fire crews. More than 36 of them are now operating in southern New South Wales over national parks, forests and farmland. The $9 million to install and run these cameras over 5 years has come from government and private investment. Executive Officer of the Softwoods Working Group, Carly Portis, says already this season the cameras have helped to prevent fires taking hold.
Notifications of fires within minutes of a puff of smoke being detected. That doesn't mean that someone in a tower would not have picked that up quicker, but certainly what the cameras are doing are finding those black spots where towers don't currently exist. So what we are starting to do is fill those gaps and sort of put all the pieces of that puzzle back together as far as fire detection.
Have you seen some examples where these detection cameras have already shown their worth?
A fire on a Sunday morning about 10:30 a.m. at Carabas State Forest. Being on a Sunday morning, we weren't a lot of contractors around, there weren't a lot of tourists, weren't a lot of workers. That camera picked up that fire within a couple of minutes and it was responded to and put out within 2 hours.
Matthew Mill from the Riverina Highlands Rural Fire Service says the cameras also provide vital information to help shape the response to a fire.
Identify the severity of the fire, how quickly it's growing in size. We can then look at the direction that it's going and then we can now send more crews when they're required to that incident.
Forestry Corporation Regional Manager Roger Davies says fire is the biggest threat to plantations.
And we work hard to prevent it because it can be catastrophic to the industries that rely on and the communities that rely on the forest industry.
The South West Slopes region of southern New South Wales has felt the impact. 45,000 hectares of pine plantations were razed in the 2019-2020 bushfires. More than 80% of that has been replanted, but Roger Davies explains that it'll take decades for the industry to recover, and they want to make sure the resource is protected.
Time is everything when you're growing a forest and getting those products to market. And so we've really needed to lift our game in terms of how can we detect, prevent and extinguish any fires that are in the landscape threatening this resource.
The New South Wales Government's $13 million Plantation Fire Protection Program has funded 3 extra cameras, along with automatic weather stations, pumps and water storage, and a specially designed firefighting unit that can handle the rough terrain of plantations. Tower operator Catherine Clark thinks the cameras and AI technology is useful, but she doesn't think they'll replace her just yet.
Yeah, I don't think AI is caught up with the natural eye, and I do believe the natural eye is better, but it is great for confirmation, and sometimes they beat us too. But it's not about that. It's about all the tools. So we have the cameras, we have the people, we have the community, we have the crews ready to go. So it's actually a team.
Fire tower operator Catherine Clark ending that report from Emily Doak. or from fire to rain, and after months of hot, dry, windy conditions, outback graziers across the border around Broken Hill were given some reprieve over the weekend when as much as 50 millimetres fell in some parts. Reporter Bill Ormond spoke to a number of landholders, including Brett Anderson from Simrick Station, about 185 kilometres northeast of the city, about what it means. Britt says that she and her husband Mick were anticipating this rain for a while.
We've been watching the Weather Channel consistently on the hour, I think, for a few days, knowing that all the monsoonal type weather was coming from the Territory and Queensland was getting a bit. So we were hoping, but you never can actually tell until it's in the gauge. So, yeah, we've been watching and watching, and finally it came. We had to be exceptionally patient, and it came at least 24 hours after forecast, but it came. So we had a 26 mil early hours of Sunday morning, and then another 11 mil around, I think it was around 3 p.m. Sunday afternoon.
And what impact would that have for you guys out there?
A massive impact, because we've only had 3.5 inches for the whole year prior to this rain. Things were getting quite dry. There was a couple of dams, sheep were getting bogged in. So to have running water and for some green pick to come up, we'd actually started feeding cotton seeds. So to have a rain now is absolutely godsend.
And what was your reaction of yourself and Mick as well?
Mick is looking like a Cheshire cat. He's walking around very smiley. Yeah, we've been walking around, looking at puddles, watching creeks, floating down creeks. It's pretty amazing. And to have the girls home from school, all four of us here, it's pretty great.
What were conditions like before this rain?
Things were exceptionally tight. The really hot winds that we've been experiencing the last couple of months have done a lot of damage out here. There was a lot of discussion about whether we destock, try and get adjustment, sell as much as we can, all those type of discussions. We'd got a road train of cotton seed in, feeding that out. So, yeah, things were pretty dire. It was a bit triggering. It didn't feel like that long ago we were in severe drought. So it's been an absolute complete 180 for us to have that hope that the season, well, the rest of this season and the summer season is set up, and to have that water in the dams is, yeah, you can't measure that.
Britt Anderson from Simbrick Vale Station. Now, Bill Ormond also spoke to Rob Pearce from Sunnydale Station, south of Broken Hill, who recorded around 50 millimetres at his house gauge.
Yeah, sort of, you know, come out of the blue a bit on Saturday, and because it's been really dry and no sign of rain, and all of a sudden, sort of lunchtime Saturday, it sort of developed to the west and sleeted across towards the house, and we'd had sort of 17.5 mil in about 5 minutes with the wind and the rain, and thunder and lightning was just massive, and then on and off for the rest of the afternoon, we had sort of 5 and 6 mil showers, so we ended up with 50 mil over the house, which was just unbelievable.
Those dry conditions before, do you want to explain what they've been like?
Oh, it's certainly getting dry for the majority of people, especially for surface water feed, and you know, the amount of ferals, like lots of people with goats, you know, that was hard to control, and kangaroos was the biggest issue for us, was small kangaroos that you couldn't do anything with, and they were drinking your water and eating what little bit of feed you had left. So hopefully with this rain, and we caught some water in certain spots, and hopefully it might scatter the roos a little bit, especially because, you know, they've been a major problem for most people.
You couldn't ask for a better Christmas present, could you?
Oh, absolutely not. It's only a start, but, I mean, you've got to get that start. So, you know, we caught water in certain spots, but we still got a few dams that never caught any water. But it just gives you hope over Christmas, and disappointing for people that miss out, you know. But, I mean, we've missed out plenty of times before, but at least if it's about and it's only 10 mile away or 5 mile away, well, at least it's getting closer.
Rob Pearce from Sunnydale Station, and in that interview with ABC Broken Hill reporter Bill Ormond about the widespread rain that we saw over far western New South Wales over the weekend.
The Country Hour. Celebrating 80 years.
Understanding how they grow best.
The Country Hour.
Nourishing the people in their own community.
Part of your community for 80 years.
It's highly regarded.
Weekdays at noon.
Go straight to the source.
On ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
Well, carbon sequestration and agriculture can coexist. That's according to the Australian Government commodity forecaster ABARES. The recent Net Zero 2050 plan called for land-based sequestration to play a significant role in the transition and would need 119 million tonnes of carbon to be sequestered in the landscape by that deadline. Executive Director Dr. Jared Greenville says that will require projects across approximately 18 million hectares. He tells Megan Hughes, not only is that possible, the agriculture industry can continue to grow at the same time.
There's been, I think, a fair bit of debate and conjecture, particularly in light of the net zero plan and as the economy is looking to transition to net zero, about the role that land-based sequestration is going to play in helping offset, which I often term of kind of residual emissions or emissions that we just find it really hard as an economy to shake because it's really costly or it's just really hard to do and there's not other options. And there's been different numbers come about looking at that. And we really wanted to kind of take a look at, you know, so the latest modelling that was done as part of the government process and to have an idea of, well, what would be the impact on agriculture and what would be the impact on the landscape as that rolls out?
What will be the impact?
Yeah, so we've looked at that Treasury modelling to get an idea. And so based on that projection, and it's important to really recognise that these are all projections, they're not forecasts, so not really looking at what will happen. They're just looking at, well, here's a scenario of what might happen and what does it look like if that does happen. And that called for about 119 million tonnes of carbon to be sequestered in the landscape by 2050, which is a fairly significant amount. When we looked at that in terms of understanding, okay, well, if farmers and landholders are given the choice and there's a return from participating in these land-based sequestration markets, given some like methods that exist for the ACCUs that are, you know, so we looked at, well, if those kind of things existed in a land-based sequestration market, what would be the landscape change? And we found that around 18 million hectares of land would be used for carbon sequestration, which is a really large number. But importantly, though, given the characteristics of agriculture and also what you can do alongside carbon sequestration, the impact on agriculture would be relatively small and offsetting, I guess, a growing base by only about 2%.
So what sort of land would be used in this model for carbon sequestration for it to have such a little impact on agriculture?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it's a mix of different things that are going on to give that smaller impact on agriculture. So the first part of what's going on is that it's the incentives strongest to participate in these markets where you can kind of do both. So where you can undertake some land-based sequestration and also undertake agriculture. And when we look, we see close to 60% of this change is occurring where we're seeing agriculture coexist with the carbon sequestration activities. And that's either because farmers are using a small part of their land to do that, or there's a range of different opportunities where you can do both. So you can reintroduce grazing in particular into areas after you've excluded them so that you've got tree cover and so forth build up. So it allows you to do both. And we're seeing that that's occurring in a large number of kind of pastoral areas across the country, where there's little diversification opportunities otherwise. So it's adding a different kind of agricultural activity into the mix. But there are areas where it just makes more sense from a kind of profits point of view to undertake land-based sequestration and it's replacing agriculture. And that's more in some of the high rainfall zones where there's really, I guess, good carbon sequestration potential. But at the same time, some of the agricultural returns in those areas aren't as great as you might see in the wheat chip zone, say, for example, and so forth. So we're getting that mix across the landscape, and these incentives are spreading it out quite significantly across all of Australia.
So this is the least productive ag land when you're looking at it?
Some of it's less productive. Some of it just lends itself to that co-production opportunity. But some of it is more productive, but it's just you've got the return. So it's a bit of a mix, but there is a higher concentration in the lower productive agricultural areas, and that's why the number becomes so large.
What needs to happen in this scenario, whether it's government policy or industry practice, to make this successful, to get it to the level that, you know, this modelling shows that it can reach?
Yeah, so it's kind of really reached that potential where we're having the kind of most limited impact on agriculture and allowing these diversification options and so forth like that. What the way the market operates is then really important in that sense. So it's really important that farmers do have these options available to them, and they've got the choice to make those based on the characteristics of their land and their production system. So having options and, you know, to have sequestration projects in some of these more marginal areas is really important. Having options that allow that coexistence with agriculture, either you can allow grazing to come back in after a period of withholding, for example, or that the costs of participating in the market are low so that, you know, farmers can decide that they're going to do it on a small part of their land and be able to participate in the market without the transaction costs being too high is also really important. So those, I think, are the kind of key factors that will drive this, you know, opportunity space out of this transition to net zero.
A lot of primary producers are looking at potentially creating carbon sequestration projects on their land. Is the industry, the way it's going at the moment, on track to, I guess, reach this level that's shown in the modelling?
I guess so. That's one of the things with projections. It's hard to really have a view as to whether we're on track or not, particularly because we expect that some of this to take place and start to ramp up over the next 25 years. So there's no direct targets now to really posit the view as to whether you're on track or not. So I think the way that, you know, I guess industry can get involved and on both sides in our such sequestration demand and so forth is really just to have, I guess, an understanding of what the potential is on the land, what are the opportunities and so forth. And so I think there's, at this point, you know, there's a key role for awareness and making sure that, you know, there's good information out there, that people are making decisions, not on really an emotive basis, that, you know, it's okay, well, what works best for my land, what works best for my enterprise, and then taking that next step. So I think we're at that stage rather than, you know, needing to hit individual targets or the like.
That's ABARES Executive Director Dr. Jared Greenville speaking to Megan Hughes there about carbon sequestration and agriculture. It's 27 minutes past 12. Well, let's turn our attention to cherries now. It's the time now, of course, to buy your cherries up for the Christmas table. This is what cherry farmers around the central west of New South Wales are saying as some of the best crops are coming off the trees since 2019. Reporter Emily Middleton caught up with the Managing Director of Altitude Farms at Orange, Greg Perry, who grows 15 hectares of cherries.
It's been really good. It's been challenging with some of the rain and hail events that have circled Orange, but all in all, we've had a really good season. It's some of the best fruit we've grown. So the heat's been really good to bring on the fruit prior to Christmas. There were some risks that we weren't going to get the fruit before Christmas, but with the good weather that we've had, we've been able to get into the Christmas markets.
There was a bit of rain and sort of storm and hail around. Were you impacted at all?
No, last weekend we, throughout the district, I think there was 70 to 100 mil of rain throughout the area. We did get 80 mil here, but no damage to the fruit, which was fantastic. But again, it all comes down to varietal specifics and growing techniques, which has really saved us.
And I noticed that you also have covering over your trees. Does that help mitigate any issues?
It does. It obviously stops the hail from getting in. It also offers bird protection. And for the rain, catch 22. So you still get the rain still goes into the soil. The trees can actually suck up all that water and affect the cherries. However, our growing techniques and practices have saved us, and we're in for a really good bumper season.
Fantastic. And what are some of those techniques that you're using on your trees at the moment to make sure you're getting the best cherries you can?
Yeah, it, For us, it's all around pruning techniques and making sure we've got adequate coverage around the leaf, but also irrigation schedules and making sure that the trees have got enough water and that when it does rain, it just doesn't suck up all the water and then burst the cherries. So they're probably some of the two key critical aspects of it, but then it comes down to variety selection as well.
And what varieties have you got at the moment?
Probably too many to name on here, but there's around 12 to 15 different varieties we grow to be able to give us that 6-week harvest window.
Are you harvesting them all at the same time?
No, and that's what saves us. So when we talk about varietal specifics, they'll come on at different times throughout that 6 weeks. So that cherries will usually split when they're really ripe. For some of the other varieties that have still got a few weeks to go, they're still green and aren't likely to split.
How many cherries do you think you're going to get off this year?
Yeah, so this year we've got a light to medium crop. It's not a heavy crop. We're still looking to harvest anywhere between 130 and 150 tonne on this place, which is good. But we're still a growing farm and hope to get to that 300 to 400 tonne mark over the next few years.
What's the market like at the moment for cherries?
No, look, the market's really good from a price perspective. Obviously, from a consumer, you will see high prices in the supermarket, but you will get a lot of good quality cherries out there. So I guess I'm a bit biased, but what I see out there at the moment is some really good cherries, and probably get in there and buy some because there's not going to be many left on the shelves after this weekend, and now's the time to go and get the Christmas cherries. And
if you want to have them in time for Christmas, will they last?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of the cherries have a 1-2 week shelf life, especially when they're looked after, and yeah, that's fine. Keep them cold, keep them in the fridge, and good to go.
That was my next question. What's the recommendation? Keeping them cold?
Yeah, keep them in the fridge. Just keep them cold. Normal temperature, 0 to 4 degrees, is fine.
Managing Director of Altitude Farms at Orange, Greg Perry, talking cherries here with Emily Middleton. It's coming up to 29 minutes to one. It's time to get some weather details now from Brandon Cray at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So we're still seeing a bit of rain, quite a bit of rain at Byron Bay, I gather.
There was some heavy thunderstorms last night, with Byron Bay experiencing 212 millimetres in a six-hour period. They are quite resilient up that side of the state, so there wasn't a huge amount of impacts reported as of yet. And thunderstorms are still going today for those northern parts of the northern rivers. And as well, there is a thunderstorm warning out for the northern tableland forecast districts and northwest slopes and plains.
So how widespread was that, those coastal showers? Just centred around Byron Bay, or was it elsewhere as well?
Mostly, yeah, it was centred around the kind of Queensland border and north east New South Wales, with just mostly the Byron Bay area getting the really heavy, intense rainfall.
And is it likely to continue, or has it moved through now?
So that band will begin to move through the rest of this afternoon and evening, and the whole state will likely be mostly dry and cloud-free from tomorrow. However, there is just still a slight risk of some thunderstorms in the northeast tomorrow. However, the air mass is drying out a good bit, so it will likely be more of a wind and hail risk tomorrow, just centred in the far northeast. Not a huge risk for the rest of the state.
But yesterday they did get some rain in that neck of the woods as well, up to sort of 40, 50 millimetres in parts?
Yeah, and 40, 50 millimetres were dropped as well this morning around the northern tablelands and northwest slopes and plains area. So that's where that thunderstorm warning was developed from.
Okay, and this afternoon some more maybe?
So those thunderstorms will keep going for a short while, possibly through the rest of the afternoon and into the early evening as daytime heating picks up. However, after that, they should die out in the later evening, and it should stay all dry then for into tomorrow morning.
What about the rest of the state? Has there been rain, or has it been dry conditions for most of the other parts of the state there?
Been mostly cloud-free and dry, with temperatures at the moment around the mid-20s, getting up closer to the 30s in the northeastern quarter and along the eastern coast as well, where there are still some severe heatwave warnings in effect for areas north of Sydney along the coast. However, over the next few days, there are no heatwave warnings in effect, and it'll be mostly cloud-free and kind of easterly flow will bring in some cloud for coastal areas over the Christmas period, but for the rest of the state, it should remain mostly cloud-free.
Yeah, we heard some reports of some rainfall around Albury. They were pretty happy with that, and Wagga, and I think west of Wagga as well, they got some. But that's all of that rain that they saw, that's all moved through now. There's not likely to be any more in the next few days?
Yeah, exactly. There shouldn't be any rainfall for those areas around Wagga or anywhere in the inland areas for quite a few days up to the weekend. High pressure should keep things fairly dry.
And we heard about pastoralists in the far west. They got up to 50, 60 millimetres in some parts. That's all moved through there too?
Yeah, that's all moved through from there.
And what about temperatures? Are we likely to see the mercury rise?
So for today, for the southern half of the state, getting up into the high 20s for the afternoon hours, and northern half of the state is a good bit warmer, into the 30s. Over the next few days, it kind of continues with that north-south split, with the southern half of the state in the high 20s, the northern half of the state into the mid-30s, really. And along the coast, a good bit cooler, with an onshore breeze developing over the Christmas period, only remaining in the low to mid-20s, really.
Okay, so lower temperatures, a bit of a breeze, but not much rain forecast.
Not much rain in the forecast, no, for the coming week.
Brandon, thanks for that.
Thanks, Michael.
It's coming up to 24 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, news that there will be a mandatory code of conduct for the wine industry has been welcomed by both growers and winemakers in the state's largest production area of the Riverina. The federal government says the code will be enforced by the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission and will take effect from the beginning of 2027. Emily Doak has the details.
The federal government says an enforceable mandatory code of conduct will level the playing field, delivering fairer trading conditions between large winemakers and their grower suppliers. Details of how it will operate will be developed in consultation with growers and winemakers. Chairman of the Riverina Wine Grape Growers, Bruno Bromble, says there's some key things that growers are looking for.
I think growers knowing what price the grapes are going to get by the 1st of October, which is important, gives a grower's ability to grow a crop or say, well, I'm not going to grow a crop this year. I'm not going to make any money. I'm going to lose money. So I'll just abandon them or just water them to keep alive and probably sell the water temporary. And the other one is important is the terms of payment. You know, we need terms of payment as a necessity. Like I said, there's wineries that haven't paid in full yet and they're not going to pay the next year. So it's a necessity. Growers can't survive if they don't get paid for their fruit. Dispute, it's probably number three. Quality assurance, which is out in the vineyard. BOMA specification, which now growers are picking BOMA higher than what's supposed to, and then they could probably penalise if they go under. But when they go one or two BOMAs over, they just lose a lot of fruit in the, they lose a lot of their crops. There's four issues there, and there's other issues we probably look at. Probably they're minor issues. But like I said, there is two important issues that we need to discuss urgently.
Chair of the Riverina Winemakers Association, Andrew Calabria, says there's broad support for the code, but he cautions that it won't fix the underlying challenges confronting the industry.
This process has sort of been in the pipeline for a long time. So there's support, but I think it's probably just sort of understanding that it's not going to correct the current market conditions, which are pretty low at the moment with an oversupply of Australian wine and globally as well. There's a surplus of wine and consumption dropping. So the industry's facing some headwinds and challenges. So I think the code is a good step in the right direction, but obviously not going to correct all those challenges that we're facing overnight.
You say it's a step in the right direction. I suppose what sort of benefits do you see potentially in having that code for the dealings between winemakers and grower suppliers?
Oh, look, I think it's really just making sure that there's open transparency. Obviously, the wine industry between growers and wineries have been trying to work towards that. So I think this sort of helps that transparency piece evolve and really just probably adjust to where the market is.
We've heard that this new code won't come into force until the 1st of January 2027. Local wine grape growers are a little bit disappointed by that, saying they would have preferred it to have been introduced earlier to at least cover the beginning of next vintage and provide growers with notice by, say, October about the prices that would be on the table. Do you think that that's a
a fair time frame, a year to get this code up and running, or could it potentially have been introduced earlier?
Probably does warrant that year's time to ensure that the right people are sort of driving the ship forward in the right direction and not just relying on agencies and consultants who aren't really facing those problems. So, again, we're facing many challenges. I think everyone wants to try and sort of start to claw out of them. But at the same time, I think if we get this right, that hopefully we're sort of setting the landscape for the future of the wine industry. Like I sort of said before, it's not going to correct our current issues, but it does sort of help probably align them in years to come.
Chair of the Riverina Winemakers Association, Andrew Calabria, saying that there's support for that code, but he cautions it won't fix the underlying challenges confronting the industry. That report put together by Emily Doak. It's 20 minutes to one.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years.
We're 3 hours from Catherine, doing School of the Air.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories on ABC Radio.
The state government has announced it will invest an additional $9.5 million into the management of varroa mite from next month. The New South Wales Varroa Mite Management Program will provide continued support needed to the honeybee and pollination-reliant industries following the winding up of the National Varroa Mite Management Program in early February next year. $4.4 million will go towards research and development, $1.1 for education and training through TOCAL, and $2.4 million for Honeybee Biosecurity Extension Program. And a further $1.6 million will fund a honeybee compliance program with 4 compliance surveillance officers. National Varroa Mite Transition to Management Coordinator Tamara Prentice spoke to Kim Honan about how the money would be spent, starting with those new positions, ones that the New South Wales Apiarist Association had been lobbying for, along with some cash grants for chemicals.
They are sort of work hand in hand with the bee biosecurity officers. So the bee biosecurity officers go out and do education with beekeepers and try and lift, compliance with the code of practice and best management practice within bees. The compliance officers come in and they're able to drop in on an apiary sort of unannounced and just check whether people are doing the right thing or not. So one of the key concerns that we have at the moment is misuse of chemicals. So internationally, there's a lot of resistance. We don't have that yet here in Australia. Our chemicals are highly effective, but misuse of chemicals like under-treatment or leaving the treatments in too long is the key cause of those chemical treatments failing. So those officers are able to get into an apiary, check that the chemicals are being applied appropriately. They'll also be checking for everything else. So AFB, one of the key issues in apiaries around New South Wales and Australia, they'll be able to check to make sure that people aren't moving that around the state as well as everything else, compliance with the code of practice and just general honeybee biosecurity requirements.
So this program will continue surveillance across New South Wales and the impact that varroa mite is having on the industry?
That's right. So the Bee Biosecurity Program has a surveillance network, and so it's not it also looks at some of the hives within New South Wales, but they've got a Sentinel Hive program near ports of entry as well. So that's just making sure that while we're fighting varroa, we're not missing out on other things that might be coming in from swarms that might make it here from overseas. One of the biggest fears in the industry at the moment is an incursion of Tropolalops. It's another mite, and we don't have that here in Australia. We definitely don't want it here in Australia. So continuing to monitor those surveillance hives is absolutely critical to make sure the industry aren't fighting a double whammy or anything else as we go forward.
And a big portion of the funding will go towards research and development, $4.4 million. Where will that be going? And will the honeybee industry be consulted on their R&D needs?
Oh, absolutely. So this program of research has been developed in consultation with the honeybee industry as well as the pollination dependent industries. So the program of works that has been announced today addresses the key needs that that those industries have called for. You might have heard recently that there was a failure of pollination around Bilpin in some of the apple orchards. We believe that that's been based on the impact on wild bees from varroa, and that industry and all of the others that do rely on pollination will now have to rely on managed hives. So the program of research and development that has been announced aims to support both the bee industry through looking at breeding varroa-resistant bees, also monitoring chemical resistance. As I mentioned, internationally, that's one of the biggest issues that industry faces. As well as looking at, from a commercial perspective, what's the most effective way of using those chemicals. But it also has a large component looking at alternative pollinator diversity and activity within some of the industries that are most heavily reliant on pollination services. So looking at what our native pollinators might do when they're most active, and whether that's going to, or what proportion of crop needs that might fill in for. But also then, in terms of managed hives, what is the best way to place those hives within those orchards? Like, is it in one large drop? Is it spread across the orchard? How many do you need per hectare of whatever crop it is that you're growing? Just to make sure that we're supporting those pollination-dependent industries with as much information as we can while those wild pollinators, wild European honeybees are sort of impacted and dying out from varroa.
And on the high costs of treatment, the beekeepers, the APRIS Association, are saying that they're seeing a lot of beekeepers leave the industry because of those extra costs. And they had been calling on the government to provide financial assistance. Mm. Is there any, you know, direct grants, any funding for beekeepers to help cover these costs of the chemicals needed to treat varroa mite in this $9.5 million?
Not within this $9.5 million, no. So there was discussions around grants for the cost of treatments when the national program was being discussed. But the way that different beekeepers manage their hives made at that national level a decision that the ability to equitably distribute funds to support those beekeepers couldn't be done. And so the $9.5 million that's been announced doesn't include grants for beekeepers. We did provide reimbursements to people that lost their hives early in the piece, but at this stage the decision's been made that the best way to support beekeepers is through education and investing back into that industry to try and really lift across the industry in the longer term, rather than like a short-term bit of support, you know, which might not result in like in a longer-term gain.
That's Tamara Prentice, who's the National Varroa Mite Transition to Management Coordinator. She's leading New South Wales negotiations for what the state is doing post-transition to management, and she was talking there to Kim Honan. It's 14 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello, I'm Stephanie Smale. Join me for The World Today. Contentious new laws come closer to passing in New South Wales as community groups flag a Supreme Court challenge. How to bring people back from radicalisation as the government reveals a disturbing number of children on terror charges. And Donald Trump's plan to build a golden fleet of battleships as regional tensions rise. Those stories and more coming up on The World Today.
And getting some texts on those gun laws as well that have gone through the lower house, still to go through the upper house. Maybe some changes there. We'll have to wait and see. Someone's texting in to say, crims and terrorists will always have guns regardless of any gun laws. But Sarah's texted in and she's put out a question saying, please ask the farmers why they need more than 10 guns. And she says, thanks for asking that question. It's coming up to 12 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, there's something pretty special about a fresh Christmas tree. As you know, whether it's the smell or just the experience of picking one, it's becoming a bit of a new tradition in Australia. But wherever you are or wherever you've gotten your real tree from this year, there's a good chance that the original sapling came from a farmer in New South Wales Central West. Lawrence Ranson runs Spruced, a Christmas tree farm just outside of Bathurst, and he caught up with the reporter Emily Middleton, where he explained how his business actually came about.
I went to Germany, did some work over there on a Christmas tree farm while I was studying, and Yeah, they were pretty high tech, pretty amazing, and growing weird varieties I'd never seen. Did some research back home and realised we only have one variety, a couple of farms in the whole country, really, like big ones. Thought, oh, there's an opportunity there. Started trying to grow these strange trees from all over the world and failing in the beginning, yeah, in my, you know, rental backyard in Wollongong, where I started. But ended up building it up, learning a lot, and moving site. We got a place much higher altitude. They started to grow really well. And slowly, yeah, the story ends up out here in the middle of Central Tablelands growing, yeah, firs and spruces and all the things from Europe and the US and, you know, their favourite varieties, where they grow quite happily. Yeah, doing really well.
That is fascinating. So were you growing, like, seedlings in your backyard in Wollongong?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God. I had, like, a little experimental lab building, which the power bill was nuts for that, like, with lights and things. And I had my mates had a share house, and I turned their back lawn into a nursery to the landlord's chagrin. But, yeah, it started like that. And it was too hot in Wollongong, so we kept losing things. But did learn a lot and sort of cranked it up slowly from there into, yeah, buying this farm out here.
How many trees do you have? What's the
how big is it here?
That's okay.
Yeah, lost track. We have in the tens of thousands in the ground. They take like 7-8 years to mature, so we have like a cycle. We're planting about 10,000 a year, and this year we've cut 6,000 or 7,000. You know, you can't cut every, there's always some uglies that we have to get rid of, but basically I try to turn over about 8,000 to 10,000 a year.
It's a lot of Christmas trees.
A lot of Christmas. Yeah, it is. way too much for this region, but they go to Sydney, they go to Brisbane, Melbourne, all over the place.
Can you tell me a bit about the varieties? You said you've got all sorts of, all kinds from all across the world. Yeah. How did you get them? How do they work? What's the situation there?
Oh, yeah, so that's the fun bit, you know, dabbling with new varieties. We've got a few that we're doing as cut trees now that work really well. And one is the classic radiata pine, like the Aussie classic that you see everywhere. They're easy to grow and they're nice and fluffy, good smell. We got Douglas fir as an American tree that does really well here too, and is really like dense and some sort of symmetrical, so that's what we can see around us here. They're doing really well and very popular, and we're playing with about 50 other varieties which not all are going to be very commercial, some of them looking like a 10-year crop, 12-year crop, but they're really cool. We've got blue spruces with like a bright blue color, and we've got like firs from Russia and from Canada and all sorts of places, yeah.
And so do you just sort of pick them up from overseas and or bring seeds over?
No, so we started, there's not many of those trees around, and I started searching. We weren't really able to import many. There's a lot of strict rules around biosecurity. But turns out that collectors 100 years ago in towns like Orange had planted these trees, one or two of them. And we found them, and they've got like a map now with like trees pinpointed everywhere, and we go and collect our own seed, yeah. And climb the trees and pick the cones. And yeah, and that's working really well. There's so much in Australia if you look around.
That is fascinating. Yeah, oh, my gosh.
That's a really fun job.
Yeah. So you're literally just on the lookout for trees always, different types of trees?
Yeah. Yeah, basically scanning. Whenever we're driving somewhere, I'm like, oh, my God, it's a giant sequoia. And we'll pull over and get cuttings or get seeds straight away. Botanic gardens, you know, they're often quite helpful. If you, you know, people's front yards, I've traded a case of beer for a tree climb, if they let me. Big sacks of seeds, and then you've got 5 years supply. It's quite a fun job. I just tour around the East Coast.
How do they then grow, like these, all these different varieties, how do they go in a place like here near Bathurst,
yeah,
where it is sort of a cooler climate?
Sort of. Some of them struggle. Like I've got a subalpine fir, which is sort of not really loving the Australian summer, you know. Some things won't work, but mostly, like we're up at 1,000 meters or just over, they do pretty well. Like the winter's just cold enough to grow them.
You collect the seeds from all sorts of trees. Can you tell me about some of the ones that you found around the Central Tablelands that have surprised you, I suppose?
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, like Orange is just a hotspot for cool stuff. But, you know, there's a bunch of parks and a golf course. The TAFE there is just full of these varieties planted by nerds 100 years back or whatever. Some of them are 50 metres tall, which is a pain. And the cones are always at the top. So climbing them is scary because you're hanging onto this trunk that gets thinner and thinner and wobbles around in the wind to get those cones that are always right up there. You know, I'll put on my reflective vest and my climbing gear, and people tend to not mind.
Right, so you properly climb the tree, because I was just sort of imagining a ladder wishes.
Yeah, it's pretty dangerous. So I've got like the harness and stuff, and I've got these boots with spikes that grip on, and they don't crop every year, so it's only every few years thing. But yeah, I'll go up to the top and collect them. There's no other way. By the time they fall, often the cones are already open. There's no seeds left. So, yeah.
Right. So how did you get into the climbing aspect of getting the seeds of these trees? Where did that come about?
Necessity. The best thing is if you're out in the country, like on a farm, you can just take a rifle and shoot them off. I love doing that. Much easier. But in the city, you can't do that. So you have to climb. There's no other way. Cockatoos can be helpful. They'll nibble on a cone and then drop, 80% of it untouched. So they do a lot of work for me, the white cockies. But yeah. It's a challenge.
So how many, I guess, would you be growing a year of these sort of unique varieties?
Oh, too many, according to my wife. Way too many. But we've got, there'd be 120-odd varieties that we're experimenting with. Maybe 30 or 40 look promising. Some are just, not going to work. And then we've got, I reckon we're doing 200,000 or 300,000 seedlings a year now and supplying other farms around Australia and landscapers and farmers and gardeners and... Yeah, heaps. That's become as big as the cut Christmas tree business.
So are you sending a lot of them off to other Christmas tree farms?
Yeah, we now grow maybe most of the seedlings of Christmas tree farmers in Australia. That's become a nice little income outside of Christmas. So we send them off in winter and they plant them. I reckon we're doing, there'd be 100,000 a year for other farmers, I reckon, yeah.
Other Christmas tree farms that people would go to, they'd be...
Probably
trees from
here. I think we really got going with that about 6 years ago, and it takes most of the pine. Most people get pine, radiata out of pine, because it's quick and easy and tough in the heat. I reckon they would be mature by now. Yeah, so probably a lot of them are from here originally.
You've been doing this for 10 years now, even though you started in the backyard.
In the backyard as a hobby. Yeah.
What brings you back every year?
Oh wow! Well, lately we don't get time to think anymore. We're just running behind the eight ball, going, oh god, keep up. But it's pretty fun, especially the experimental stuff. I love that. And we are getting pretty good at the routine things, which is now a lot of our work, like pruning every tree twice a year. That takes 3-4 months. Just every single tree needs a minute of attention. But, I've got my audiobooks and I've got my music and we've got a good crew. We have some fun hanging out. It's outdoors most of the time, which is nice, actually. And, people love it. They'll get a lot of really... very happy people coming to the farm and with their kids and running around laughing and having a great time. So it's nice to see that too.
That was owner of the Spruced Christmas Tree Farm, Lawrence Ranson, talking there to Emily Middleton.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, as the weather heats up, Queensland feedlots are leading the nation when it comes to shading cattle. A new report from the Australian Lot Feeders Association shows 81% of cattle in Queensland feedlots now have access to shade, a big drop from 62% back in 2020. Alpha President Grant Gehry says it's a voluntary move that's paying off, improving animal welfare, productivity and reputation.
We've made great progress. We're up to... over 1.3 million head of cattle now with shade, and that's up from 800,000 head back in 2020. So, today we're at 75% of constructed capacity with shade for cattle in feedlots across Australia.
Queensland is leading the way in this initiative. How is it going?
Certainly Queensland's leading the way in the terms of percentage. It's also got the most cattle on feed. We're up to just under 82% now of cattle on feed in Queensland with access to shade, and that's grown by over 300,000 head since 2020. So it's been a big effort by lot feeders in Queensland.
So looking at the other states, New South Wales is up to 74% of cattle having access to shade. Victoria is on 61%, South Australia 53%, WA 39% and Tasmania 30%. What's behind the differences in uptake? Do we know why Queensland's leading the way?
It's a hotter climate and probably more conducive to having shade installed in the hotter climates where it sort of started, and then it's certainly starting to grow and be used more as well in some of the more southern areas.
So putting up shade is a voluntary initiative, and I'd imagine it would be quite expensive. Why are feedlots installing more shade?
Yeah, look, people are installing shade for animal welfare reasons to help manage cattle during, you know, heat load events. It certainly brings with it some animal welfare benefits and productivity benefits as well, especially in those difficult climatic conditions.
That's Grant Gehry, who's the president of the Australian Lot Feeders Association, speaking there to Brandon Long. So the national figures, 75% of cattle have access to shade in Australian feedlots. That's up from 56% in 2020. And in New South Wales, 74% of cattle have access to shade in New South Wales feedlots now. That's up from 57% in 2020. So some big changes there as a result of the move to more shade being available, a voluntary process, but it seems to be paying off, they say, in terms of animal welfare, productivity, and also reputation. We're heading up to news time.